proud to announce Kenny Fennell. Kenny is an emerging mobile strategist at WSP and obsesses about how we're going to move around cities, suburbs, everywhere in the future. Welcome, Kenny.
Thanks for having me, Gene. I'm excited to be here.
Maybe for a starting point, Kenny, tell us a little bit about what WSP does.
That'd be great. So WSP is a global services firm that advises public and private sector clients in four areas, from transportation to water to energy. In my role specifically, I focus on future mobility, and my work is primarily based in the U.S. And so I'll advise city and state governments and private sector clients as well, mobility operators, on strategy, policy, and innovation. My favorite project right now that's descriptive of that is preparing some research-driven white papers for an automated vehicle company to understand how their services interconnect with topic areas from land use and social equity to electric vehicle infrastructure and the environment.
Got it. So you're really looking at it from across the spectrum, from working with companies, mobility companies, to working with the public sector on kind of enabling those and provisioning from those. And
exactly.
You know, what would be helpful is to rewind the clock for us. December of 2019. Can you describe what the conversations were like generally with the cities about mobility? I'm thinking about everything from, well, specifically Uber, Lyft, ride sharing, and the jump scooters. What were they thinking about at that point back in December?
Yeah, so back in December, everything was really ramping up. It seemed like we were hitting our stride, and we were starting to see more innovation, more public-private partnerships where a private company would deploy in partnership with the government to solve a common problem in a way that benefited both parties, whether it was increased revenue from a hard-to-reach market or whether it was solving a social problem for a government, like a particular area of the city that had hard access to jobs, so ultimately reducing the unemployment rate. And we saw this across a variety of services, from trip planners and mobile payment apps, whether it was federal funding to create those partnerships. We saw this in just the ride-hailing companies and various private services like the e-scooters, where they were approaching cities directly. And then we saw this just, even we began to see it, I was surprised, in the physical infrastructure projects where street space was being reprioritized for public transit and for these shared modes instead of purely private automobiles. And that's a really difficult conversation politically. And we were just hitting our stride in it when COVID happened and required the emergency response that it does.
Ask that, you know, I think about the different layers there, that provisioning streets for shared mobility, for whether it's just pedal bikes or electric bikes and scooters. And you said that was a hard conversation to have. There was making some advancements to it. And can you fill in the blank why it was such a hard conversation to have? Why, when presumably cities are forward thinking, why it's so hard, why it takes so much work to get a street, a lane in the street provision for these alternate modes?
Of course, it's a few things. The most basic of principles is that it's just simple behavioral economics. We as humans are just programmed to enjoy the status quo. We don't like change. And so anything that challenges that, whether it's removing a bike lane or even just changing our behavior to adopt a new product, we all know, and we're all well-versed in this, that's just a hard conversation to bring up. And so for the bike lanes and street space specifically, it becomes especially difficult when it's tied into politics. You know, departments of public works who want to change the streets and maybe balance modes or reduce greenhouse gas emissions in their city, and they all have these great goals, are sometimes hindered by politicians whose voters are not necessarily aligned with that use of the street for whatever purpose it might be. And so that political layer plus that behavioral economic layer really combine to make change in that arena incredibly difficult when they interact with each other.
Got it. And so at the end of the day, people like the status quo. And is it safe to say there's just a lot more people who are obviously driving than doing these alternative modes of transportation? So it's a numbers game for the politician.
Exactly.
Cool. So we move forward here, pandemic starts to roll in, and how does it change the conversation with the city's desire to continue to advance? Maybe even as a starting point, where are the cities at? Pandemic hits, what happened? What was the first kind of wave? Obviously, Lyft and Uber made some changes to their platform, but continue to operate. But the usage dropped by, I call it, 75%. What were the cities doing when pandemic hit, if anything, around micromobility?
Absolutely. I think the most important thing, or one lens through which to view the pandemic, is that it required an emergency response. And so cities still have a desire to do this work. It's just that when something as troublesome and as widespread as the pandemic occurs, everything has to drop and all focus needs to be reshifted to make sure that we focus our efforts on the pandemic, to make sure that we're saving the most lives, that the economy is disrupted as little as possible, and that we make it to the other end successfully. So as you said, 70 to 90% drop in ridership across public and private services, from e-scooters to public transit, massive unemployment increases.
Did the cities tell the micro mobility players, get your stuff off the street?
I don't think so, no. Basically, a big pause button was hit, and everyone needed to figure out what to do. And I think folks were looking for guidance on that. Typically, that guidance would come from, on the economy, would come from the federal government, but it started to trickle down to the states. And then where states weren't taking the lead, it started to trickle down to the cities. And typically, that's just not how government works here. So it's been a challenge on who can look to who for leadership and where the response is being led. That has been a big surprising difficulty of this. So I don't think cities did not say take your scooters off the streets or make more space for this other mode of transportation or this service. What they did do was they got a handle of issues, so surveying the landscape, and then they immediately started to prioritize and come up with responses that were necessary to hit the goal of saving lives, whether it was innovation through repurposing some of their public transit services to make sure essential workers could get to and from work, whether it was repurposing budgets or things like that just to fund those services, like we saw with the federal government in releasing emergency funding for public transit and now bailing out city and state governments who are facing those massive revenue shortfalls because of the unemployment increase. So cities were quick to reply because of the emergency, but we'll see what happens in the coming months here as we continue to be in the pandemic. Honestly, it's more of a response framework than a knowing what's going to happen.
So yeah, within that response framework, are the cities, how you talked about one of the projects that you're excited about that you're working on today, was all encompassing. But what's the tone of the cities? If they were kind of their engagement around advancing mobility was before the pandemic a 10, what is it at today?
I'd say the desire to engage is still at a 10, and then we're just running into difficulty in terms of resources, both in time and money. And so a lot of the work I've been working on has continued, and that's what I hear from colleagues around the industry and just what we see. Some of the work has been accelerated, work like the Oakland Slow Street programs where they opened up 76 miles. Those projects had kind of been in the works and gone through a lot of processes already to get them implementation ready. And so the city said, hey, this was going to be a net benefit. This looks like it provides even more benefit given social distancing requirements. Let's just make it happen.
So what did they do? I'm not familiar with what happened in Oakland.
So the city of Oakland, in response to the social distancing requirements for residents, they opened up 76 miles of street space specifically for people who want to go on a bike ride, specifically for people who want to go on a walk, to get out of the house, to kind of, whether it's going on a grocery trip, getting the mental space from being in stay-at-home order or otherwise for those essential trips. So that project had been in the works,
but
it was expedited. It is a big deal. Yeah. It kind of ties back into the challenges of doing that I spoke about earlier. So the desire is still there. Some efforts have been accelerated, but as we continue to go through this, there's uncertainty. We're going to see folks maybe be more cautious and very disciplined about where money is spent.
Makes sense. So when the number, if it was a 10 before, what's it today?
I'd say it's a 10 in desire, but maybe a 7 to 8 in capability and resources.
Okay, so they're still moving forward. We're still meeting and trying to continue to plan for this future. And when you talked about the space, having kind of allocating space for whether it's different modes of transportation, what are the other big topics that are on the minds of municipalities?
Some big topics on the minds of municipalities in regards to mobility that are not directly related to just moving people or goods. It's definitely a lot of the supporting infrastructure. So data use and privacy is a big topic, whether you're talking about the California Consumer Privacy Act and how all technology and internet companies are going to have to comply with that. But also the mobility data specification. What level of data is necessary in real time for cities, for public agencies, and for private operators to effectively meet their needs. That's a big part of the conversation. Again, transportation is kind of, it's related, it touches on a lot of fields. And so sometimes the narrative is driven by what's happening in other sectors. And so as our energy system electrifies and moves to solar and renewables, that conversation is also happening in transportation as well, transportation electrification. One trick is to look to California and see what they are doing. That generally will guide a lot of the conversation that states in the country will take up.
What's California doing in terms of provisioning public space for charging stations for EVs?
It depends on the city. They have different initiatives at the state level and at the city level. And so at the state level, the California Air Resources Board drives a lot of the conversation. They have a lot of grants available to help communities plan for electric vehicle charging infrastructure. But this mostly refers to light truck and personally owned vehicles, charging station in your house, maybe a public charging station accessible in the city's downtown so you can charge while you're at work. The next phase of the conversation is going to be, well, what about electrifying automated vehicles and transportation network companies? We're seeing workshops happen where those conversations are happening. And frankly, it's exciting. The next thing is each city will kind of have its own working plan for these various initiatives, whether it's working on climate change and greenhouse gas reduction, or even as specific as, for example, in San Francisco, the mayor's electric vehicle working plan and working group. And so a lot of the work, a lot of the constructive conversations, and frankly, sometimes the difficult conversations happen at that level.
Makes sense. And that's a good guiding post about California using them as directional where things are going. And that whole EV infrastructure feels to me like the city is going to play a smaller role in kind of doing those. It's more up to the individual store, for example, the Target that puts in the Tesla charging stations, or your apartment building. That's probably where the onus of the charging network is going to come from. Would you agree with that?
I agree with that in the present moment. In the next, in the coming years, we're going to see if we're able to elevate the conversation and really drive it in a systems level way. And if cities will have the funding and the power to make a more distributed network happen, for example. So, if we have a truly shared and automated vehicle that is also electric, can it, in its operations, charge freely when it needs to? Or are we going to have a lot of deadhead miles and things like that when charging is needed? But again, I agree with you. It's a future conversation. It's not where we are in the moment.
But we could have a world where a municipality finances 100 different charging stations within a parking lot or next to some public transport, something like that. I suppose that would be in the mix.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, you mentioned kind of the shared piece, that the dynamic on sharing space has changed. What is the impact, the long-term impact, let's say 2 years plus from now? How do you think people will view ride sharing and using jump scooters?
So is this, I think, a good parallel example on my opinion of this is what's currently happening with e-commerce right now because of COVID. And just bear with me for a second. There was a recent Pew Research poll that I believe showed about 25% of people who would never consider, you know, ordering from Amazon, ordering from Grubhub, have started to do it. And they've started to make it a daily habit, partly because of the shocking behavior change that we've all needed to make. You know, we still want to have our in-person experiences where we can, and we still need access to the goods that we desire, whether it's food or whatever have you. And so I think the same in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, the same dynamic will play out with shared mobility and shared spaces. People will just become more used to it if they grow up with it. You know, I didn't grow up with a scooter, but you know, my younger siblings, as they grow up with these things, they just become everyday normal items. And so it's not a shock for them. It's not a change for them. It is the status quo. And so that's kind of the market who this will be normal for. And so it'll just continue to be normalized in that way.
And you think people's kind of concern for their own safety and does that kind of, you talked about people just want to maintain what is, quote, normal. Do you think that we will just drift back to people being comfortable at getting into people being 100% of the people comfortable at getting back into these vehicles? Or do you think that it's 90% come back? What's your best guess?
My best guess is that most of the market will return. However, that doesn't mean that the fundamental challenges that existed prior to COVID have suddenly disappeared. So 90% of the market comes back. Let's put that out there. However, we're really only going to reach the numbers we want in terms of ridership volume if we can solve the fundamentals, which is making sure we provide that safe street space for folks who do want to get around in something other than a private car when they need to. And it's going to require just, you know, the hardware and the software to continue to evolve to provide that seamless experience that people want. And so that I think is the hinge and the factors that play into enabling those specific product features and experiences are the hinge. So that's what we're looking for.
Got it. And I would love to shift in two additional topics, or three additional topics. One is just on this kind of shared space, these shared lanes. Fast forward 5 years from now, what does a typical U.S. city look like in terms of those? Do we see a fractional increase, a decrease in the number of those shared spaces, a dramatic increase? Try to quantify what it's going to look like in 5 years.
So in 5 years, I think we will continue the progress that we've currently seen. COVID provided a shock to accelerate some of those plans, but I think as that ends, and we've already seen this, Minneapolis and St. Paul have started to pull back on some of the streets they've opened.
So they return them to car streets?
Exactly. So they've started to return them to being solely for private, personally owned vehicles. And so I think we'll see an effect there, and then a return more to the pace we were on before, unfortunately. but again, that's a result of just budget and time to spend on these projects. There's only so many things we can get done every week, and that's unfortunately sometimes the cap.
It's so disappointing that, you know, we make that step forward, and then it kind of steps back and understand why that happened. And I think it really speaks to your earlier point that this is just, it's hard to get these changes. So it's your interpretation would be that we will see more of these in 5 years, more of these kind of dedicated bike lanes, if you will.
I believe so. I just wouldn't say that it's going to happen at an accelerated rate, but it is coming. It's just coming on the same pace as it was before COVID. Now, I'll qualify that saying we're still in an active and very dynamic discussion around COVID and what's needed in terms of this emergency response, so that could change. But this is today, as we speak, what we kind of see happening.
Okay. Two more questions. One is just on the ride-sharing space more broadly, kind of given what you know about Lyft and Uber, do you think one of them is better positioned than another? Does one of them work more closely with the city, have different culture that maybe some sort of competitive advantage when it's dealing with some of the regulatory pieces?
From my view, I'd say they're relatively on equivalent footing. If we remember, there was back in the early 2010s, or maybe the mid-2010s, there was this position that Lyft had taken where it tried to align itself as the friendlier kind of ride-hailing service. But they've kind of defaulted, or not defaulted, but intentionally taken the same strategy here in terms of how they engage with public sector counterparts. And so it speaks for itself in a way, in terms of the tactics they've taken. They tend to, state their interests very strongly, if I'm going to put it politically correct. but I wouldn't expect them to shift. That's kind of their position. It's been their position for a number of years.
But culturally, they approach the city similarly, or you said that Lyft kind of initially was that perception around Lyft, but do you feel that they kind of have the same rapport, I guess, with the city officials?
Yeah, that's been my experience, and I think that's kind of the read from the market, and what we've seen is that Lyft is, they're very, this is what we do, we offer ride-hailing service, and we need to make sure that we reach profitability aligned with our interests as a company to offer sustainable service. Again, that's where we are today. The conversation on this is changing, and we're seeing that change with groups like the Open Mobility Foundation, the Society of Automotive Engineers recently released a working group that brought some public and private sector stakeholders together. And NACTO does the same thing, the National Association of City Transportation Officials. And so you'll see public and private sector clients in there trying to hash out these difficult conversations on data privacy and land use, congestion pricing and things like that. It's just not as public, it's not as loud as other tactics that we see in the news when Uber and Lyft or TNC, files a lawsuit against the city. But they're both trying to push us to a better future, just different ways of going about it.
What advice would you give to a startup that was approaching a city to get provisioning to operate in a city?
It highly depends on the stage of the company, but let's say it's like a Bird or Lime, because that's the level at which you really, when you're trying to scale, you're trying to access various markets. That's when you're likely to have these conversations. If you're really, really early, approaching a city to understand the market landscape might be helpful, but it might be challenging because the city might not see you as a serious player yet. So the startup has to achieve some scale before these conversations are really fruitful. That said, so in terms of Lime, a Lime stage company, I'd say just keep an open mind. Be proactive in the communication. And try to see the city as a partner. Now, that doesn't mean acquiescing to doing everything the city demands. Obviously, that's not a tenable relationship either, but I think Spin has a really good model on how they've approached cities. They see them as partners, they talk them up, they also offer constructive dialogue when something that a city wants just doesn't work. If, for example, a hypothetical situation, if a city wanted to add a $1 or $2 fee for each ride, that might make the unit economics incredibly unfavorable and even unsustainable for these companies. And so it's knowing where you have common overlap and it's knowing where you have to push back and say, I can't do that and here's why. But again, it's through that constructive dialogue.
I would like to end with just how you envision, let's go 10 years kind of out, your exit a restaurant and you look at a road, street. What do you see? Does it look very similar to what we see today, or are we going to see different types of vehicles? And would love just to hear that kind of vision.
Absolutely. When I look out at the street today, it's remarkable in how homogenous it is. In the U.S., I'll speak to the U.S. It's in my own backyard. It's in Minneapolis. It's typically four lanes, all dedicated to cars, with 5-foot sidewalks where people have to try and dart around each other to make space. Exactly. However, we know in other places there are streets that are thriving. They have space for people to go shopping for the products they love. They have space for people to have an early dinner evening and enjoy the sunset at their favorite restaurant.
What are those cities that you kind of think are aspiration cities about what their streets, what the life feels like at the street level?
I'd say European cities. From London to Paris to Berlin to Amsterdam, they offer a good example of what a livable, enjoyable city looks like and is at the human level. Obviously, we have to find our own version of that in the U.S. To an extent. And it'll be based off of what we want access to and what we enjoy and how we want to prioritize. But what that looks like is more larger sidewalks, more lanes dedicated to specific modes. Whether it's somebody who's on a bike, someone who's on an e-scooter, maybe lanes, although they could operate by sharing one, is delivery robots that we're already seeing being tested by Amazon in the Seattle area. And it's going to be just more human-sized vehicles and human-sized experiences. So a lot more folks in the street, a lot more folks doing what they love. And a lot of different vehicle types, from scooters to automated delivery robots and automated vehicles darting back and forth to get us what we need and get us to where we need to go.
I love that future. I want to be a part of that. And you've inspired me to want to take a vacation once the flights are back open to Europe to enjoy those simple pleasures. Kenny Fennell from WSP, thank you for joining our Frontier Tech podcast. I learned a lot, and bye for now.
Bye, Gene. It was a pleasure. Thank you.